Without fail, digging into the Old Testament leads us to wondering about the God being portrayed there. Whether it's a God who asks a father to sacrifice a son and then at the last second withdraws the request, or it's a God who seems to wink at, if not approve of, people who lie and deceive their own family to steal a blessing, or just about anywhere we turn, we run into stories not only of strange cultural practices, but in many ways, a strange God. At least, a God who doesn't seem a lot like Jesus. And we haven't even gotten into the war and conquest stories yet. What do we do about these pictures of God, other than quietly avoid them, which is a typical Christian response? I get it why some people don't read the Old Testament very much. They would rather read gospel, good news. But to turn away from the Hebrew scriptures is to turn away from gold. It's to miss the hidden treasure. What we have here is a story of God through human eyes, which of course is the only kind of God story that we can get. And here we see what the people saw in God, in retrospect, from their own cultural framework. A limited view, naturally, but even in these rough sketches of God, a beautiful picture begins to emerge. We catch golden glimpses of the God we see in Jesus. The gospel can be found right here, in these ancient stories. But like panning for gold, we may have to stir up the waters a bit to find the piece that glitters. All that is to prepare us to meet the God of Exodus 16, who gets angry without good reason, or so it would seem. The people of Israel, many thousands of them, are making their way across the desert and need a safe and reliable source of food and water. They cannot survive otherwise. Without it, they die. One chapter earlier, they came across a spring, but the water was undrinkable. They cried out to God about their situation, and the water became sweet and safe to drink. Then in today's story, it's a source of food they lack. The Passover lamb they ate the night of their escape from Egypt had long ago been digested. And they were now famished and near starvation. They were having dreams, or maybe hallucinations, of overflowing stew pots back in Egypt. Slavery had an upside. At least there was food to eat. Now, wouldn't an all-knowing and compassionate God be anticipating exactly that response and exhibit some empathy for what they were experiencing? Well, we're told Yahweh does send them quail that drop from the sky and edible manna that settles on the earth like dew. But the way these acts of God are described, we get the impression that God was angry at them because they grumbled, and that God provided food only under duress, as if God was caving in to their petty demands. In fact, the retelling of this story in the book of Numbers, it's clear that God was deeply offended by the complainers. So much so that fire fell from heaven on some of them and they were consumed. So it sounds like, at face value, these stories tell of a people who cry out to God because they lack basic necessities of life. And God, semi-reluctantly, if not angrily, caves into their demands and gives them what they need. So what kind of God is this? What if the people had not mentioned their dire straits? How long did God want them to wait meekly in the desert, dying for lack of food and water, before God sent relief? God could have rained down manna any time. Why didn't God take the initiative to provide before the situation got desperate? And why would God be angry at such a legitimate complaint? These are things I didn't understand when I first heard the story in Sunday school in Florida. And I still have trouble with it today. But take heart. There are some glittering pieces of gold in this story. So let's shake the pan a bit and look. I see in here a glimmer of God's extravagant mercy. Mercy undeserved by the recipient, as always, a gift. The gift of God's presence in plenty and in want. In fact, the long story of how they got to this place, how a workforce of thousands of slaves could escape from Egypt, slaves on whose back Egypt built its economy, that's a huge glimmer of God's grace. God noticed their suffering and worked out an elaborate plan, not only to bring them out, but to have them leave with good riddance and piles of valuable jewelry and marketable goods with them, given by the Egyptians. That miraculous escape was fresh in the minds in today's story. It happened only days or weeks earlier. Yet, many of them are longing to go back. But we sort of get that, don't we? We still see that happen today. When someone newly freed misses that shred of security and predictability that they had when they were in an abusive relationship or lived in a country that oppressed them or something like that. Sometimes people would rather go back into abuse or oppression than face a frightening and uncertain future. So maybe God's anger is easy to understand, because we ourselves have known that kind of anger. After we go to great lengths to help someone find freedom from addiction or from abuse or some other oppression, and then we watch this person we care so deeply about and have invested so much of our life and love into turn right around and go back into the arms of that which held them captive, choosing oppression over love and freedom. At the very least, God's anger here in this story, I believe, has less to do with people begging for food and drink and more to do with people who God loves, rejecting God's generous gift of love and wistfully yearning for the scant benefits of slavery. We see God here as a spurned lover, a lover who poured out all his love and longing and power and miracles to carry out the greatest rescue operation in human history. And they want to go back. Maybe some anger seems justified here after all. But I see another piece of glittering gold. The story of manna itself is rich with grace and gospel. God offers the former Israelite slaves a new and gracious gift. It is called enough. Enough. Something they don't have much experience with. They knew all about having terribly little as slaves, or having a great surplus as they left Egypt loaded down with jewels and gifts. But what was this concept called enough? Notice how the manna was dispensed. And I quote of verses 16 to 18, they were told, "Everyone gather as much as you need, an omer for each person in your tent." The Israelites did as they were told. Some gathered much, some little. And when they measured it by the omer, the one who gathered much did not have too much, and the one who gathered little did not have too little. Everyone had gathered just as much as they needed. Unquote. Now, the text can be a little ambiguous, but to me, it sounds like getting manna, in fact, wasn't the only miracle that happened here. God performed a miracle of wealth redistribution as they scooped it up. If a young man with a big scoop and a strong back happened upon a spot with an extra heavy layer of manna, and an old woman with a small scoop and arthritis and poor eyesight went out and found only a small amount of manna, when they both returned to their house, they both ended up with one omer per person. Not too much, not too little. Exactly enough. And the story gets better. Later in chapter 16, right after the part that we read, God comes through with another gift, Sabbath. One day a week, they could rest from the manna harvest. The sixth day of gathering would yield a double amount, and it would keep for 2 days. If they didn't prepare for that and went out on the Sabbath anyway, there would be no manna, and they would be hungry. Furthermore, there would be no hoarding of manna. Any other day, if they picked extra, trying to stockpile it for the next day, it would be full of maggots in the morning. Except on the Sabbath, it would stay fresh exactly one extra day, no more. The gift of enough. The gift of Sabbath. These gifts came from the hand of a loving God, a God of grace and gospel. Pure gold. When the community lived as God intended, following God's direction, basic needs were met. Some who worked extra hard ended up with less than their labor produced, and thus persons who were less able to labor still had enough. It's a beautiful story after all. And it's a gospel word for us still today. Life isn't always fair. Some people work hard and work well and don't see the fruit of their labors for any number of reasons. Some people cannot or do not put in the time, and their needs still get met. God never struck a deal with the Israelites or struck a deal with us saying that we would always get what we deserved, what we worked for. Sometimes work and results are out of balance. Reminds me of a song of one of my favorite singer-songwriters, Sarah Jarosz. She was at Red Wing Festival this summer. Some of you heard her. The song title is Johnny. Look it up sometime. It's not a religious song, and I don't know Sarah's faith orientation, but her words speak gospel truth. The refrain of that song, which she repeats often, says, "You might not get what you pay for. You know that nothing's for sure. An open heart looks a lot like the wilderness." Our faith does not rest on God giving us what we pay for. Our faith rests on God being with us in the wilderness. An open heart, as well as open hands, sometimes still leads to disappointment. I'm not saying anything that we don't already know from experience. Our open hands are not always filled with what we expect when we expect it. And our open heart may get wounded. But what we are promised by Yahweh is that we won't be left alone in the desert. The God who sets people free will not abandon them to their freedom. God will stay with them, looking for open hands and looking for open hearts. What God wants from us while we're in the wilderness is openness. Openness. Not longing for old securities back where we came from. Not turning toward Egypt to go back to old captivities. Not hoarding the excess that we unexpectedly end up with sometimes. No, just open hearts and open hands. Yes, openness looks a lot like the wilderness. But these strange stories from the Hebrew Scriptures reassure us that we aren't the first ones in the desert to get a great gift, a God who is loving, who is full of grace, and who looks a lot like Jesus. Join me, will you, in reading together in response the confession printed in the order of worship. God who provides, God who sees and knows our need, we fail to rest and trust in the God of enough. Forgive us, O God, increase our trust, open our hands. When our enough does not seem like enough, when we claw and grasp and compete out of desperation, forgive us, O God, increase our trust, open our hearts. When we forget your provisions in the past and see only the emptiness facing us now, forgive us, O God, increase our trust, open our eyes. When we descend into a spirit of entitlement, when we fear walking into the unknown without everything already in hand, forgive us, O God, increase our trust, open our lives. Receive the good news. God the provider is with us, and that is enough. We are forgiven. We are open. We are loved.